Bobani Ghani, everyone. This is Professor Amin-Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach, former city councilman for the city of Compton, former Compton College Board of Trustees, and former Compton Unified School District Board of Trustees. We want to welcome you here to the Conscious Corner, byproduct of our podcast. And we want to thank the host of the podcast that provides us the platform, and that's Brother Rashi Key and Community Education Network. Also, my co-host is historian Joe Hembrick, that hopefully he will join us a little later. Brother Joe Hembrick is a longtime educator for the Compton Unified and Linwood Unified School District, both as a teacher, administrator, and coach, but he's a self-proclaimed historian that studied our history. You know, it's one thing to study to get a grade, one thing to study out of interest, but it's another thing to study to enhance our struggle and knowledge of ourselves and pass it on to the young people. And that's what Joe has done in many ways. We want to welcome our guest tonight, Brother Shahid. Agent Shahid, is that correct?
Ajin
Shahid, who's going to talk about unsung heroes. He's done an extensive writing, traveling, and well-rounded brother from the community. Went to Centennial and also Cal State Long Beach, and a veteran. He also went into the service, so he's traveled and he has a lot of information about his family and about other individuals that contribute to the forward flow of us as a people. So we want to thank him for agreeing to appear and share his wealth of knowledge. And hopefully that we will all benefit from this presentation. Brother Agent.
That's good enough, bro. It's a tongue twister. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. So, as Brother Ross said, I'm originally from Los Angeles. I grew up on Wilmington, across the street from the projects when I was a little boy. Then we moved to Watts, 103rd. Then we moved to Avalon. Then we moved on Antwerp, George Washington Carver Elementary. Then we moved on Elva Avenue by the Boys Club there. And I went to Vanguard Junior High and then Centennial High School. And then as Brother Ross said, I went on to Long Beach State. And then there I joined the military, the Navy, and was in San Diego. While in the Navy, I became the assistant to the Commodore of the U.S. Pacific Fleet for so-called minority affairs, racial relations, and human relations, basically to settle disputes between, I'm going to say, Southern whites and Black people. They tended to dominate the Navy at the time. And then discrimination complaints, those kinds of things. And so then I went... And I traveled and partnered with Muhammad Ali, ex-heavyweight champ. We went into business together with some other brothers, and we gathered Black expertise around the country to transfer expertise to West Africa and the Middle East. And then we did some book signing kind of things that that Ali did. Then I ended at San Diego Unified School District, where I was a pupil advocate, a position created for the improvement and achievement of African-American males program. So we focused on promising practices, culturally relevant instructional strategies, dealing with Black males kindergarten through 12th grade. So I must have worked with over 1,000 young men in my time there. And we traveled throughout the country, sharing strategies and gaining strategies there. And then I recently have become a consultant for some school district around San Diego. We have 42 of them. And then most recently, which I actually am enjoying, I joined the Los Angeles South Chamber of Commerce, which deals with South Los Angeles. And I did that as kind of coming home to continue the work that I'm going to tell you about my grandfather, what he did. And so I'm an ambassador for the chamber, and I am the assistant education coach to bring educational strategies and systems and understandings to South Los Angeles. So that's kind of me in the background. Now, you know what? I didn't bring my watch or nothing. I can't see it on the phone. Can you let me know when I've done about 20 minutes? Because I'm going to do 20, 20, or 15 minutes. 15, 15, 15 is going to be in three parts. So if you just let me know when I hit the 15-minute mark. So the first thing I want to talk about is the latest book that I've written. My company is called Changing Paradigms, and I focus on unsung Black male heroes. Is how it's begun. It will include Black female heroes. And so the latest book that's about to come out actually in another week or so is called The Musical Blueprint, Ernie Freeman, The Man and His Times. And it focuses on Ernie Freeman, who was a product of Los Angeles. He started off in Watts. He lived in Jordan Downs, right next to Jordan High School. Then he moved into the Crenshaw area, and then eventually into the Baldwin Hills area. And that's Ernie right there. And Ernie began his career in the military. He had 120 gold records, 20 gold albums, 8 motion picture themes, television specials, and commercials. And if I ask any of you other than Marilyn, who knew him, I know she's on there, you wouldn't even know who he was unless you were in the music field. So this is the purpose of Unsung Heroes. But I want to invite the listening audience, all of us, to look at our families and to really visit what I call unsung heroes. They don't have to have been in the paper. They don't have to have been in the news. They don't have to be nationally or even locally known, but maybe the neighborhood knew them or the community. And I just believe that if we start focusing on this vast constellation of unsung heroes, we will have so many role models for us to remember, but particularly for our youth to identify with. Because sometimes the youth, you know, well, I ain't no Martin Luther King, I'm not no Malcolm X, but they can identify with someone in the community, you know, someone in the neighborhood, or a family. We want to give them all kinds of role models. So Ernie kind of started off like that. So just a little bit about him. He began to play the violin when he was 4. So you could kind of say he was a child prodigy, as they say, and the piano in his church. His sister, Evelyn, created a band. She went and heard Duke Ellington play. She skipped school one day and went to hear Duke Ellington, then decided that she was going to join, create a band in the 40s. And so she created it, and Ernie was only like 13, 14 years old. So he joined playing the sax and actually doing arranging. So they ended up in clubs and all kind of playing places. Then in 1941, he joined the Navy, and all of the other male brothers in the group left, and they became the first all-Black Navy band, calling themselves the Gobs of Swing. He returned home and graduated from the Cleveland Institute of Music in the footsteps of his sister. And then with his daughter, as I said, he moved to Watts, living in Jordan Downs. In 1946, Lou Chudd founded Imperial Records and hired Ernie to work along someone named Jimmy Haskell, and a composer and arranger for motion picture scores. Jimmy worked with Elvis Presley, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Neil Diamond, Everly Brothers, kind of the white folks there, okay? Ernie brought some color. Ernie attained his degree in USC in 1949, okay? And then after that, he started traveling with Dinah Washington. Dinah Washington, for the music listeners here, she was considered the baddest female Black singer in her time. Okay. And he traveled with her, played piano with her. And then he was voice coach for Dorothy Dandridge. Okay. And traveled with her for her supper clubs and those kinds of things. So recording companies kind of got wind of Ernie. And in the 50s, he began to make music jump, as one recording artist explained. And 1957 was his big break. He did a rendition of Bill Justice's Raunchy. It became number one R&B and number four on the Billboard charts. In 1958, at the Cavalcade of Jazz Concerts, Tryon Auditorium, I don't know if it still exists, on August 3rd, with Little Willie John, Ray Charles, Sammy Davis Jr., and the Ernie Fields Orchestra and Bo Rambo, he performed there. Then in 1958, I grew up, and I'm sure Brother Rod did, but Dick Clark created Battle of the Bands. And for 3 years, Ernie Freeman was the second Black orchestra leader at the Hollywood Bowl. But he was there for 3 years playing with all the big bands. The first was actually William Grant Steele. He did an opera there back in the 30s, believe it or not. Then they didn't see nobody Black for years and years and years. But Ernie came on and stayed for three consecutive years. And when he came, six blocks away, they had to set speakers to announce that they were sold out, because everybody wanted to come see this Black man leading this orchestra, Dick Clark, and bringing the Coasters, the Drifters, you know, some of our Black greats, you know, during at least my time. I'm 72, so I grew up in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. In 1956, he did a cameo appearance with the Platters in the movie Rock Around the Clock. Frank Sinatra got disenchanted with Capitol Records and created Reprise Records, and Ernie became the musical director, and we believe he was the first musical Black director of a recording studio. So he had Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Joey Bishop, Sammy Davis Jr., Joe Stafford, Rosemary Clooney, Duke Ellington, Nancy Sinatra, and stand-up comedian Red Fox. And so Sinatra believed in creative freedom, and he allowed each of them to have ownership with publishing rights. So that was a real transition part there. So some of the movies he did, Dark at the Top of the Stairs, he did a Grammy arranger for Strangers in the Night. Frank Sinatra, Ernie got the Grammy for that. And that was Frank Sinatra's only Grammy, but a Black man got it, okay. He worked with Ray Charles, he worked with Eddie Fisher, television shows. Dean Martin, he did Ride the Wild Surf, Fabian Tab Hunter, George Raft Story, Cool Ones with Roddy McDowell, Double Man with Yul Brynner, Lee What I'm Bid with Lee Van Dyke, Duffy with James Coburn, and The Pink Jungle with James Garner. So Ernie really was what you call mainstream movies in Hollywood. And then he got the Grammy in 1971 for Bridge Over Troubled Water. Now, that church is sung in every church, that song, every church. It is the 66th most listened to song in the top 500 of all music history. And for six consecutive weeks, it topped the charts all around the world. 6 million copies, one of the most performed songs of the 20th century. Ernie Freeman, the Black man, got the Grammy for that. But who's saying that? Okay. Then he did television specials with Carol Channing, Leslie Uggams, Harry Belafonte, Carol Burnett. I do want to do a mention. If any of you remember Carol Channing, she did a lot of Broadway stuff, Hello Dolly. She decided at the end of her career, when she wrote her book, to announce to the world that her father was Black, and people didn't believe it, okay? But she announced that her, and she had told Ernie that her father was Black. And so she finally came on out.
Really?
Yeah, Carol Channing was Black. Her daddy was Black, yes. And so all them big eyes she had, okay, and that voice. So, and then he met with, he was a voice coach for Lita Chaplin, Charlie Chaplin's wife. And she told him that Charlie Chaplin was part black. Okay, so Ernie got to get the inside on a whole bunch of people. Growing up as we did, for some of us here, like Brother Ra, he did some of the scores for Perry Mason, The Green Hornet, To Catch a Thief, Alvin and the Chipmunks, and Huckleberry Hound. Okay. He also worked with Diane Carroll on tour with her and her songs and put in place. So what I'm going to do right now, I'm just going to do a drum roll because I don't know who the audience is or what age groups. Okay. But if you're anywhere in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, these names will jump out. But what I really want to do by doing this drum roll is I want to illustrate, and I actually got it from Brother Rigo, Arvashiki. You said something to me that stuck with me. You said when you read a little bit about Ernie, that as you understood it, that he has to be also credited for being the foundation of so-called mainstream white America. Okay, because you're talking about Dean Martin's, I mean, the Beatles, you know, the British Invasion and all of that. Well, Everybody Loves Somebody by Dean Martin. Ernie Freeman arranged that song and knocked the Beatles out and sent them back to England. Okay, and then Ernie Freeman, you want to do Andy Williams and Godfather, the theme there. Ernie Freeman arranged that song, okay? But again, who knows this? Who's hearing this, okay? You know, if we don't have an African name, you know, a name other than European, they just hear Ernie Freeman and just assume, you know, he's mainstream white America. So we want to demystify all of this. But I'm going to give you this drum roll now because I really want you to just hear the people that he influenced. And then when you hear these names, depending on what age you are, think about mainstream white America, critical race theory, you know, all the stuff that's going on. And then again, as Black people, we have been the platform and the foundation for much of even the mainstream culture of this society. So what he did, he was an arranger, a conductor, a songwriter, a voice coach, composing, directing, pitch, songwriting, and strings. He worked with the Ernie Fields Orchestra, which was a Black orchestra, Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Ray Charles, Andy Williams, Eddie Fisher, Quincy Jones, Robert Goulet, Mel Torme, Wayne Newton, Bobby V, Vic Dana, The Supremes, Sam Cooke, Willie Nelson, Johnny Rivers, Dame Shirley Bassey, Goldfinger, Peggy Lee, Keeley Smith, Edie Adams, Jan and Dean, the whole surf scene, Anthony Newley, Frankie Avalon, White America's Little Heartthrob, Betula Clark, Vicky Carr, Condi Francis, Gene McDaniels, Sandy Nelson, Dwayne Eddy, Jane Morgan, Johnny Burnett, The Crickets, Buddy Knox, Mae West, The Blossoms, Bobby Darin, Sandra Dee, Sonny and Cher, Richie Valens. He was the pianist for La Bamba that came out. Ernie was the pianist with Richie Valens. Johnny Otis, Nelson Riddle, Les McCann, Barbara McNair, Brenda Holloway, Every Little Bit Hurts, okay. Johnny Mathis, Pat Boone, Carol Burnett, Glenn Yarborough, The Platters, Dinah Washington, Paul Anka, Nancy Sinatra, Lionel Hampton, Marilyn McCoo, and Lamont Macklemore of The Fifth Dimension, Mills Brothers. We mentioned Diane Carroll, Dorothy Dandridge, Sarah Vaughan, Desi Arnaz, we said Alvin the Chipmunks and Huckleberry Hound. So if you look at that roll call list, okay, that's America. Okay, that's the music scene. And again, you have a Black man, okay? And this book that I put, I'm going deep into a deep dive into how he did what he did, how he created what he did. My belief is that we will soon speak of him in the same breath as we do Quincy Jones and Clarence Avant for music aficionados. And again, this will blow right out of Watts, right there in Crenshaw and living in Baldwin Hills. When he moved in Baldwin Hills, they were the first of 10 families there. And when they moved in, they had hate mail, garbage thrown all over the lawn and stuff. Nigga go home, you know, but he braved all of that. And what I want to say, ending on Ernie, that I liked about him, many performers, and it's their right, they've moved all over L.A. and lived, you know, everywhere they want to live, Beverly Hills and all of that. But Ernie stayed in the community. When Baldwin Hills became pretty much all Black, Ernie stayed there to the end.
Okay. First of all, I want to say, man, that's a beautiful history and research that you've done on Brother Freeman. But I want to see if people have any questions.
Yes.
About what you've said thus far. It's been 15 minutes, you say, let's you know.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to start with Marilyn. Ms. Carwood, do you have any questions at this point?
No, we talk about this all the time, me and us. No, I don't have any questions. Because
right.
I own Ernie, because Janice, his daughter, and I are very good friends.
Okay. Well, what about you, Miss? Is that Franklin? Victoria?
Hi, everyone. No, I don't have any questions. I, too, talk to Janice about this all the time. So I'm very familiar. But I'm glad to hear it. About it again, and to know that it's being coming to light.
Now, Victoria, don't run away too quick. Can you just say for a minute what you did at UCLA?
Oh, I was the CEO for the School of Theater, Film, and Television. I ran a number of the departments: Department of Spanish and Portuguese, the Department of World Arts and Cultures, and then the School of Theater, Film, and Television. And then I went on to work at Charles Drew University of Medicine and Science. And I was director of student education over there. I also worked with the dean for the College of Medicine on strategic planning. And then my favorite thing was I started a STEM program with one of my colleagues where we worked with At Promise Youth to just let them understand how brilliant they are in the STEM fields and what they can do in the STEM fields.
And I wanted Victoria to just say a little something because Victoria also knows about Ernie Freeman, and this individual such as Dr. Ron and Victoria's and others, you know, to get this information out. Thank you, Victoria.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure.
Yes.
Looking forward to the rest of the presentation. Hi, Marilyn.
Right. Hi, how you doing?
All right. And Sarah, did you have any questions? You're on mute.
Yeah. Hi, I joined a little bit late, so I haven't heard too much, but I don't have any questions so far.
All right. And what about Darlene? Darlene Galaxy?
Okay, no, I don't have any questions. I'd just like to hear Gene with his history classes. I'm a member of the chamber as well. Thank you.
All right. Brother Mashinda?
Yes, no questions. Just want to thank the guests for bringing this to the forefront. A lot of the artists that he mentioned, you know, I'm very familiar with in terms of, you know, the American, like I said, American culture, what was, you know, what we were submerged in. And, you know, and a lot of times, you know, Black people being behind the scenes or even being, you know, on the main stage or the main, you know, creator, but not getting credit for it, you know, it's not on the, you know, and that's, you know, so I just appreciate that part of it as well, you know, just to share information. Look forward to hearing about more of these heroes, and thank you again for coming.
Good. Brother Hembrick, Brother Joe, our co-host, yes. Brother Hembrick, are you there? You're on mute. All right, Brother Rashiki.
Yes, Victoria and Marilyn mentioned Janice. Can you tell us who Janice is?
Yes, Janice is
Janice's
daughter. And Janice's daughter currently lives in Delaware. Her husband was a very famous coach at Rutgers University and was responsible for placing a lot of Black males in the NBA and whatnot. He was always in Sports Illustrated. And so Janice has created a national campaign to get recognition from Ernie. And this is a good point to tell us that she just got a letter back from the National Black Museum of Culture and Arts in Washington, D.C., and they are now going to recognize Ernie. She sent about 3/4 of his collection to them. I mean, they got all them gold records and everything. Okay, and they're going to put it into the music exhibit there and do some future things and writings on him. And then Ernie's originally from Cleveland. He actually grew up with Mayor Carl Stokes, the first Black mayor there. Okay, and another brother who did Dreamgirls on Broadway. And so they're going to recognize him. The mayor is going to recognize him and do an Ernie Freeman recognition piece there. And so Janice is alive and well. And the book that I wrote, every sentence we went over for accuracy because she was there.
Okay. Brother Rossi, any more questions?
Oh, that's it for now.
All right. A couple other people then chimed in, but we'll get to them on the second session. I just have a few questions and commentary. First of all, we want to thank you for this excellent research. But as you were saying, he's an unsung hero. When you took on this venture, what made you go into the history of this him as a musician and his contribution to the world of music?
It started with my work with the Pupil Advocate Program for the Improvement Achievement of African American Males in San Diego Heights School District. Because I'll tell you a sad story. It was an elementary school that I started with deep in the heart of the Black community of San Diego. I put up an exhibit called Out of Africa Came Great Americans. So for the Out of Africa, I put the Great Kings of Africa, if you can remember visually that. And then Came Great Americans. I focused on inventors and scientists. Okay. So I had each young man from kindergarten all the way to sixth grade. I took classroom by classroom. I had them stand in front of that exhibit and had them come one by one and tell me what they saw. Out of 176 young men, only one of them said, I see kings a great man, so I'm going to be a king and I'm going to be a great man. The other one said things like, I see slaves, I see poor people, I see. So it showed you, and these children basically came from a so-called middle-class Black community, okay? Franklin Frazier's The Myth of the Black Bourgeoisie, okay? So these children, you would think, might have had access to whatever, and they see slaves and they see poor people and this type of thing. So now coming to your question, I thought it was really important. And when I began to meet with my cousin Janice, just to get through the COVID, we used to meet every Monday for a year. We would talk and just catch up. And she would tell me about her father. And I said, well, you know what? I like to write a little pamphlet. So I said, but once she told me about him, I said, this ain't no pamphlet. I said, this is a book. And so that's how it evolved into the book that we have. And again, I think you'd be very pleased at the comprehensiveness that went into this book to understand Ernie, his place in history, and his influence on the music scene. I personally think he's one of the biggest kept secrets in the 20th century as a Black man in music. Because, you know, we got musicians everywhere, but don't nobody understand about Ernie Freeman?
Yeah, I understand that, but was it, because he came up in a time of a lot of, in certain areas, a lot of racism.
Yes.
Even in the music industry, with regards to royalties and with regards to, as you say, recognition, and there's a lot of contribution. But my question is, how much do you think, what contributed to the suppression of his recognition as a genius in this area and his contribution of playing with so many artists and during a period and going to SC and graduating is suppressing because sometimes we have Black astronauts.
Yes.
But many of our kids don't go into space because they don't get a chance to interact with them. And then they don't even know who they are.
Right.
And the same thing with students who are may want to go into music.
Right.
And not just, you know, popular music, but in depth getting degrees or musicologists.
Yeah.
How much of you think this was suppressed? Like they suppress votes and suppress other things that we do as a people. And how much do you think was just overlooked and no one really just focused on it? And it was just an accident that nobody, that he's not a household name and he's an unsung.
I really appreciate the length and breadth that you just went over, because actually it is a strange story in terms of events. And very briefly, first of all, Ernie died when he was only 58 years old, early in his music career in 1981. At that time, he was running neck to neck with Quincy Jones. He would do something, Quincy would do something, they would do something, kind of a thing. And so Ernie also was a person, and his daughter would tell you, as I asked her, Ernie wasn't trying to floor show or advance himself. Sometimes in that field, you know, you got to do some little floor show, a little advancement. Okay, Ernie wasn't that kind of guy. He just loved his music. He did what he did, and that was that. So I'm going to offer to you that when Quincy emerged on the scene to become the Quincy that he is all the way to the day, okay, a phenomenal Clarence Avant, that they began to overshadow and Ernie with the things that they were doing in the current times, what they did in the 80s and the 90s and in the 2000s, you know, was so prolific that some of the things that Ernie did just began to get pushed back because, you know, today's culture, the so-called the new normal. When I was working with the People Advocate Program, I showed some young ladies the screens and they said, who are they? Okay, you know, that's what happens, with music. So that's what I would offer in a nutshell. It really wasn't any grand conspiracy, but I'll end with this story. Janice actually was on the plane and going to Washington, D.C. She was sitting next to this little white couple, and they noticed that they had a hat on, Ain't Too Proud. So they knew the play about the Temptations that came out. So they saw him again in the baggage area. And so they started asking her all kinds of questions about the play. She says, oh, you really know a lot about it. He said, well, yeah, I should. I directed and wrote it. She said, oh, well, my father was in music. She said, oh, what's his name? Ernie Freeman. I knew Ernie Freeman. So now there's your example. People in the industry know and would remember if they're still around and alive. It's just the mainstream everyday culture that doesn't get a chance to hear that name. Because as a conductor, as an orchestra leader, as an arranger, you know, those are not in the forefront. That's not in the forefront. So that's what I would offer with that. And so, again, that's my whole thing about unsung heroes. Unsung heroes really are not recognized. It isn't just the big R racism. It isn't in there. Sometimes it's just a strange set of events that get them that way. And it's up to us advocate and to bring them back into the light.
Okay.
I gotta make a joke about you. When I heard about Ra, I've been hearing about Brother Ra for years. I had no idea that he was the sleepy that I knew, because when I knew him, he was a star basketball player. And somebody told me, you know, I said, I don't know no Ra. He said, it's sleepy. I said, oh, you are an unsung hero.
Yeah, well, you don't want to wake him up. You know, but anyway, Sister Victoria, you had your hand up.
Yeah, yes, I agree with Ajin. I think that played a huge role in it. His own personality, not having to be in the limelight, doing the work, being the brilliant musician and creator. A lot of creative people, they don't necessarily have to be in the limelight. They just want to birth their creativity. Mm-hmm. But I also believe it's the time, because now, you know, we can Google people. I mean, we can, there were quite a, I, because of Janis, I've seen a lot of articles that were written about him. So it wasn't that he was hidden. I think that it's just the time also. There were a lot of people who were doing many things in the 50s, 60s, 70s, but we didn't know their name, because now we can Google somebody, or they can start becoming more famous. Their name can be higher recognition because of social media and, you know, all the, you know, we just have more access to information. And so I think that that probably played a role in it also. One, his personality, his temperament. He didn't need to prove anything to anybody. He was brilliant. And then to the time that we were in, when information was less, I'll just say, public to everyone. But I mentioned to Janis, his daughter, that when I looked at the 45s, I never really noticed that the arranger was named, written on the 45 records or on the records. And I just never noticed that before. And so I think he was known, but like you say, Eugene, in the industry, extremely well known. But yeah, to the public, a lot of people weren't known. I mean, you know, I try to Google other people who I know have passed away young in those times, and it's very difficult to find something on them.
Yeah, well, Gene, again, your research is profound and needed and appreciated. And I remember the 78 and 33 speed record.
Yeah.
And we had record players before there was cassettes, before there was thumb drives, and before there was streaming and all of that. So I understand what you're saying. I think I got a collection of 33s and things of that nature. I'm gonna go back through them and see if I can find some of his name on some of the records. But anyway, could go with your second part. That was first part one. And you want to continue?
Mm-hmm. Part two is another unsung hero, dear to me, because he's my great-grandfather, Charles C. Flint, the man in his times. When I was coming up, my grandmother, who was a very quiet, reserved person, she just never told us about Charles C. Flint. You can see him right there on the front next to me. And so I just didn't know a lot. Well, one day my mother called me up. She said, I need you to come help me go in this here trunk. I said, well, what's in the trunk? All kind of family stuff. And I'm embarrassed to say she asked me for 15 consecutive years. I just couldn't find the time to do it, trying to raise kids and all of that. And so finally, one winter holiday when I worked in the school, so I said, Mom, okay, Mom, I'm coming. You're going to wear me out with this. And so I stayed for the whole winter holiday, and we went through the trunk. And when we went through that trunk, the information that surfaced created this book, Charles C. Flint. So who was Charles C. Flint? Charles C. Flint was a Black man who came to Los Angeles in 1884. He came from the silver mines in Carson City, Nevada. There he opened up a restaurant. People came to his restaurant. He was known as Tony the Chef. Okay, he came to L.A., opened up a grocery store, and he, let's just say, he integrated what we would now call downtown Los Angeles. One end of downtown, if you know the story of Biddy Mason, who was a Black woman who owned most of downtown, on one of the extreme ends of downtown was a lower class of the white population. We're going to say that lower class of the white population, kind of an embarrassment to Los Angeles. And then right next to them grew this emerging Black and Black middle class people. It was called Brick Road Street, with successful businesses and stores. And so there was kind of this little clash going on there. And then finally, we know the history. It just wasn't working out. So the Blacks started moving towards what we now call Central Avenue and developing the Central Avenue, you know, community kind of a thing. But Flint was right there in the middle. So who was he? Charles C. Flint came from Washington, D.C. He went to a seminary school right behind Booker T. Washington. Okay. His father was a sailor. Okay. His sister married Matthew Henson, the explorer, the Black explorer of the North Pole. So that was my grandmother's uncle. And so Chelsea Flint grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, shaking and moving, having a brother-in-law like a Matthew Henson. So by the time he hit Los Angeles, you know, and when Blacks came to Los Angeles at that time, they have to have a few coins in their pocket, okay? If they made it all the way to California, there wasn't no city to city like we had to do as Black people, no green book, no none of that. If you made it to California, you had to come with something in your pocket. And so most of the Blacks at that time came with a little something in their pocket. He was one of them. And for example, in 1911, 37% of all Blacks in Los Angeles owned their home. We don't even have that stat today. Okay, so Blacks were really living interesting, and Charles C. Flint was the face of that. So I'll just give you some stats. In 1890, he was the district committeeman campaign in 1896. In 1896, he went to the Chicago Republican National Committee. You know, Blacks were Republicans there. 1897, he was the first vice president of the State League. 1898, he was the vice president of the Silver Republican Club. And in 1898, he delivered speeches for the Fusion ticket. In 1898, he was the assistant to President McKinley as a chairman of district committee at the Republican Convention. In 1898, he met T. Thomas Fortune, who was the famous Black newspaper man after the Spanish-American War, and they were putting their thoughts together about Black folks across the West. By 1900, the Black population was 2,133. And in there, he attended the Silver Republican Convention. Then in 1902, he obtained membership of the Los Angeles Retail Grocers Association. Doesn't sound like much now, but they just wouldn't let Black people in those associations. But he got in. And you got to really get a picture of Charles C. Flint if you can see him. Charles C. Flint, okay, was very African in appearance. He had one leg, okay? So, and there he is with the African-American Congress. That's right there in L.A., in 1896. So Los Angeles really had to get used to, you know, Black folks commanding respect as he did. Okay. And I'm not trying to do this little color thing we do sometimes amongst ourselves, but he wasn't pear colored. He didn't have wavy hair. He was brother. And when you hear the things that he did, that makes him stand out even more. Okay, so then he joined the Merchants Exchange in 1902. I'm just doing a little timeline thing here because of time. In 1902, he addressed the Los Angeles Socialist Party. I have an article in there. And after he addressed them, they wrote an article blaspheming him, because they said he tore the house up. White folks just went insane, okay, because he told them about themselves in 1902. And their answer to him was, if the socialists, no, we don't need to help you Blacks. We can barely help ourselves as whites. And that was their answer, okay, the Socialist Party in 1902. Then he opened, 1906, another grocery store on Santa Fe Avenue. In 1906, he was elected president of the Colored Businessmen's Association, married his second wife. He wrote an article on the Brownsville riot. Then he was very involved with the city. So on July 30th, I have a lot of primary resource documents, things never seen before in contemporary Los Angeles. So this book is a gold mine for primary research documents. So you're going to see things like a Good Roads rally in 1908, where he's the guest speaker. You're going to see how he was on the board of Los Angeles Industrial School in 1908. You're going to see that he did a thing on the anniversary celebration of Abraham Lincoln at the AME Church in 1909, and a big article in the Los Angeles Times. Charles C. Flint was best friends with the founder of LA Times, who was a white that really gave voice to the Black population, people like Flint. And so Flint would write articles and they would be on the front page of the LA Times. It was just a different time for Black folks there. Okay, Chelsea Flint placed the first Black teacher, Bessie Brewington, in the public school, who eventually became a principal. He spoke on many race meetings. He worked with all the Black newspapers, and Chelsea Flint was an independent. He wasn't Republican. He wasn't Democrat. He wasn't anything. He said, I'm just with those that are going to help Black people economically. And so he resisted any real main platform. Okay. He was very anti-Taft. I have an article in 1912 where he blasts Taft. Okay. He opens his third. Now here's the big one. In 1913, Flint runs for city councilman. That's you, bro. In 1913, against Wesley J. Bryan, and he almost defeated him. He had the Black and white vote in 1913, but the good old boys club just couldn't have it, okay? Then in 1920, we had 15,579 Blacks. He married his third wife. He wrote an article, Why the Neighborhood Store Should Be Patronized. Then he wrote a letter on California Poet Laureate John Stephen McGordy. He was friends with him. He received letters from Senator Samuel Shortridge. In 1925, like it, he went and bought a Model T and paid cash. My grandmother was there. She said the white owner's mouth almost popped open when he paid cash for a Model T. So he was one of the few white and Blacks that was riding around in a Model T, okay? Then we have a letter from W.E.B. Du Bois that's in the book. Then his son-in-law, which is my grandfather, James McFarland Irvin. James McFarland Irvin became our second Black administrator for L.A. Unified School District. He was over the Black attendance program, basically doing the same thing that I was doing in San Diego Unified School District. So actually I'm a second generation, okay? And so he got Irvin in to do that. And it's a little story with that, and I'll just minimize it. Let's just say that the white folks didn't like Irvin being there. And let's just say all the attention that was going on. And let's just say that they framed him. And in the book, because I don't want to give it away how they framed him, it's some real Black man stuff, okay? And so he was an all-white jury in Compton, because Compton was all white, okay, declared him guilty, fined him $3,000. That was like $30,000. And he was out of his position, which is what they wanted. Okay, so I don't want to give it away. You have to read the book to see how he came out of that and what he did, okay? And so Flint went on to do articles against any candidate. He worked with all the Black newspapers at the time as their writer. And so I would say to you that if you get this book, what's going to be to your delight, I'm thumbing through it, when you see all these pictures, when he got his position, all the HBOs, Fisk University, Clark Atlanta, everybody, they wrote letters to Los Angeles commendating them for hiring this Black man to look out for the welfare of Black students in the school. A little bit more on him, his father, and in my book, I have a bonus chapter at the end on James McFarland Irvin, on Chelsea Flint. His father was James Nelson Irvin. Who was he? The dean of Jarvis Christian College, one of our 100 Black universities in Hawkins, Texas. You know, when we couldn't go to the white schools, that was one of the schools they can go to. And he came from that kind of background, with a father who was president of a college who graduated from Columbia University in 1906, okay? So that's another whole story. I don't want to get on that tangent, but you're going to get a treat, a little hors d'oeuvre, when you not only read about Flint, but you read about James McFarland Irvin and the things that he did. He ran with Jack Benny's Black guy with the Jack Benny Show, and they did a lot of firsts in L.A. that you'll learn about that he did. So let's stop there because of time. This is a 3-hour conversation on this one. But I hope that I've introduced you. It's on Amazon. Charles C. Flint, The Man in His Times. Any questions?
Well, before you do that, why don't you do the third one and then we answer questions after that one?
Okay, very, very good. Okay, so the third one is Our Roots Run Deep, The History of Blacks in Los Angeles, in California, 1900 to 1970. So I co-authored that book with John William Templeton. You'll be interested to know that John William Templeton is doing two interesting things about now. He presented with Dr. Shirley Weber, who's one of my mentors from San Diego, and she currently is our Secretary of State, Black female. And, she just got the reparations bill passed. Okay, so this is big. So John Templeton, my co-author here, he presented a position paper there. So, to get past all that and get that passed, his scholarship was raked over the coals. Okay, so if he sees something, it is. Okay. Well, he goes on to talk about Queen Calafia, okay, that the state of California is named after a mythical African queen called Queen Calafia. And I'll give you a little snack here. He's getting ready to work on a documentary movie. It will take place in South Los Angeles. And there's going to be a little sister at one of our schools who becomes president. And then she wants to name the school Queen Calafia, and everybody's going berserk when she tells them that California is named after a Black queen. Nobody want to hear it. Okay, so the whole thing is going to be set on there, and then you learn about this Queen Calafia and how all that came about. That's a very large story that we don't have time to talk about that took place in the 15th century. Garcia de Montalvo wrote about her in the 15th century, and Hernan de Cortez went to the king and queen of Spain, coming here to look for this Black queen named Queen Calafia. Why was he looking for a Black queen? Remember, the Black Moors ruled Spain for 750 years. They had no problem thinking of a Black woman as a queen. They had no problem thinking she was the most beautiful woman in the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They just thought that they was over here too, and they were, if you know about Black Aboriginals. But that's another whole story there. So now in that, my last part that I want to share with you is I just came from a family reunion. And the family reunion, and this is an unsung hero, this is new for me. I am going to admit that I went into a very racist stage of my life against mainstream white culture. I was in the Nation of Islam, and as you know, we had some interesting thoughts about that population, okay? And I had those thoughts too. And so, but I knew, like most of us, that I could trace my roots that would include Europeans, Native Americans, as well as Africans, okay? So I didn't really want to have anything to do with the European part. Well, anyway, I decided to get past all of that and did some research, and here's the story. I'm going to introduce a white hero for Black people, brand new. His name was Lloyd Ford Jr., and we just went to a reunion because the state of Tennessee, of all places, created with their historical group a 7-foot placard on a highway talking about the Ford versus Ford case. In the brief summary, it went this way. In 1848, he wrote a will, and his will said, in summary, I leave my 111 acres to my, whatever you called them at the time, I don't know if they said Black, whatever they called our people at the time, but us, 111 to my 5 children who love me more than my white children, because the white children had all grown up. They had their own individual land. Only the Black ones was right there, and he lived with them. He lived to be 95 years old. So he went into his humanity. They lived with one another, and he left them the land and their freedom. The white kids, 10 of them said, excuse my language, hell to the no. You ain't our brothers and sisters. You're not even getting an inch of land over our dead bodies. And so they spent 3 years going all the way to the Tennessee Supreme Court. And the most interesting thing happened in 1848. a white judge named Judge Green in Jonesboro, one of them all-American towns in the Revolutionary War, said, quote unquote, these are human beings with inalienable rights of their creator. Watch the language. But for the misfortune of having be put into enslavement's work, that they have arrived in slavery, but they have inalienable rights, they can own property, they have et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That was unheard of for the time. In the book, The Peculiar Institution, which I did read to some of my kids, they had the Ford versus Ford case. I didn't even know that was my relative. It was my fifth great grandmother who convinced her white father. She said, look, if you don't set us free, they gonna sell us. They don't care about us, and we not getting nothing, okay? So he did that, and he was a Revolutionary War hero. He was in the Revolutionary War. Jonesboro was the foundation for abolitionist movement in America, and so a white female named Phoebe Stewart, they couldn't represent themselves in the court, so she represented, and they won. So we all came together for the first time, whites and blacks, Fords, after 175 years, that section of us, not everybody was for this, as you might guess. Not everybody, black person, wanted to go. My son did not want to go. He was not interested in meeting white folks and stuff, and that's that, and that's okay, okay? And both sides came and meant to change this, and on the T-shirt it said, Fords love Fords. And let's look at this thing differently. And so in summary, that's what happened there. I'm going to declare him as a hero for his day. I'll end to let you know just what he went through. His oldest white son got him drunk, held him at gunpoint, and said, because he gave the will to his next door neighbor, if you don't destroy this will, I'm going to kill you. Okay. I'm going to kill you because you done lost your last mind. Okay. He went to the next door neighbors. The father, Lloyd Ford, was illiterate. His crazy son was illiterate, a white son. And so the Fords next door, who were literate, showed him a piece of paper that wasn't a will and threw it in the fireplace. They thought it was the will. So Lloyd came back the next day. What have I done? Oh, my people, I disappointed them. So you ain't did nothing. And so that's the end of the story. And here we are today. Now, that's a short version of a big old giant story. So Lloyd Ford Jr., Revolutionary War, Caucasian American, stood tall for the day, embraced the humanity of his children, and gave them the land and the freedom over his white children. Who are some of the descendants of his white children? Tennessee Ernie Ford, the famous singer, is a descendant of those white children. By the way, when the court case was over, they packed up, because they owed everything and everybody, packed up and skied off and left the town and left everybody hanging, okay? And their descendants to this day didn't even know anything about the court case, didn't anything know about any of it. So all of this was new information to the whites of today who are embracing change. So let me stop there. That's another long story. Any thoughts about what I just said? I can't hear
you. Professor Rod, you're on mute.
Good, good, good. Okay.
Again, this fantastic information. We deeply appreciate your presentation, but we want to see if anybody have any questions. We're going to start with Norma Allen. Norma, do you have any questions?
Hi, Norma. We went to school together. She went to Centennial with us.
I know.
He knows.
Okay.
The question I had is any of that 111 acres still in the family, the Black people's family?
Know what happened? The one male town named Larkin, he held it for three generations. And then his generations wasn't interested in staying in Johnson City, Tennessee. Okay, it ain't the biggest place in Tennessee. And so they eventually sold it off. We looked at the land, and guess what now? We calculated one of their relatives. We have a cousin named Jane Howard Martin, who is a descendant of Rhoda, the black slave woman. She's my cousin. She is vice president of Toyota North and consul general. Okay, so she got the research engine, and she said that property is worth $1 billion now.
Amen. Amen.
$1 billion, but they let it go.
Oh, that was the only question I had.
All right. Well, Norman, again, how you doing? I hope all is well. You know,
Everything's well. Good to see you. Yeah, it's been since 1960s.
Yeah.
Ooh.
All right. Victoria, you had your hand up. Franklin, go ahead.
I have a question. Do you know if anyone has from your ancestors, were they buried on that property?
Yes. They were buried. Lloyd Ford Sr. owned over 2,000 acres, okay? He was an indentured servant, okay? An indentured servant, but remember, I'm going to say the rejects of Europe, and it's okay to use that language, came over here looking for a better life, did the indentured servant thing, and they could walk away getting 2,000 acres of land, okay, to start their life and their world, okay? And so there was a cemetery that's in Johnson City, and it is now, I'm just going to say it, tall grass and overrun with snakes, and nobody's stepping foot in there for years, okay? So we're working on trying to get that cleaned up so we can go in there, but that is the cemetery where the blacks live. It's a funny thing again for me, again, and I'm really advocating now, I really mean what I'm saying now, we have to stop being afraid of genealogy, some of us, and go ahead and get into genealogy, okay, because you're going to find out some interesting people in your family, okay, and many of those whites that own our ancestors had money, okay, and circumstance, okay, so I come from 5 white families in Tennessee, and I can go into some other stories, okay, and so all of us can find out some things like that and find out some interesting ways how our families got leveraged, okay? And sometimes, they, you know, grandma and aunt so-and-so, they don't want to talk about it, but we need to interview our elders and find out some of them stories, because sometimes they say, oh, I know, that didn't happen. Yes, it did happen, okay? Just like this story here. Because you can, I ain't no white man going to give nobody no 111. Yes, he did. Okay, so let me stop there.
All right. Norma Chambers?
I'm sorry. I had a part B, if you don't mind.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And so if you know that some of your ancestors were buried, some of the, you know, African descent ancestors.
Right.
What can you do with that? Because if it's burial ground, that's a whole different story, you know?
Well, that's where we get into reparations.
That's why I'm asking you.
No, that's how we get into reparations, because John Templeton told me, even though they passed the bill here in California, it's going to take almost 2 good years before they vet out how that's going to get distributed. Is it cold cash? Is it college? Is it start a business? What is it? But you got to be able to trace your ancestry back to enslavement. So I'm among the fortunate, but I'm still inviting the audience. It's not as hard as you think. Find out who them white families are. Don't be afraid of them no more, because that could be your ticket to success to get what's due us on reparations. Okay, all the Japanese people got $20,000 a piece. Okay, you know, after what they did with them. But let me stop right there. Now, Norm Chambers is coming on. He's a friend of mine, and I'm doing something here. I've always wanted Norm to meet Victoria, so now you guys gonna meet each other, and we'll talk about all that later. Okay.
also reparations, when they took our homes, when they did the 10 freeway and the 110 freeway.
Right.
You know, that's another conversation that is starting now.
Yeah, well, Victoria lives in a Paul Williams home. Architect Paul Williams, Victoria lives in one of his homes. Right there on, off of Adams, right?
A little tiny regular people Paul Williams, not a mansion. But my, but we Paul knew Williams. Him. we knew him. Well, my family knew him growing up. My mother saw him build this house, and I'm friends with his daughters and who have passed away and his grandchildren. But yeah, probably yeah. Well, that's another story. And our, and Jean's ancestors and my ancestors knew each other also.
Yes, yes, they did. Yes, they did.
In Los in L.A., early L.A. Nice to meet you, Norman. I can't see you, but I see your name.
Yeah, Norman Chambers. Did you have any questions for Brother Jean? Are you there, Norman? You're on mute.
All right, can you hear me?
Yes.
Making
okay. Yeah, I like to. I like to sort of. First of all, congratulate my friend, Jean, for just his investment and his insight and what he's doing. And it's a real important example of what can be done in the future. One of the concerns I have would be that I'd like to find out what does he hope to be going on, say, 2 years from now with what he's working on now. For example, I'm wondering, is that a second phase to all that you're doing now?
Yes. One phase would be from my work. Norm actually trained me. Norm is one of my mentors, okay? He's mentored me for 48 years, as a matter of fact, okay? And he has quite a background himself. But I want our children, as you know, I'm very interested in our children. I want this information to get into the school systems. I want them and get past all this critical race theory stuff, okay? In our private schools, our charter schools, our public schools, I want teachers, what I call culturally relevant instructional strategies. I want them to infuse this into the curriculum, okay? So that our children have these examples. Because in LA, and I'm gonna say it this way, Black people, Black children don't have to hold their head down at all because the foundation of Los Angeles, Black people did everything you can think of. It just hasn't been, the whole story hasn't been told. When you read this Charles C. Flint book, you're going to be shocked at what Black people did in LA. So no wonder we produced the Tom Bradley. No wonder at one time we were one fifth of the city, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I know the white press tried to blaspheme Compton and say when we had Dollar High that it was an experiment in government. We haven't been experimenting anything. We've been governing ourselves for a long time. But let me stop there.
Brother Norman, you have any other questions?
No. Not, I think he did respond to what I had in mind. He knows I'm interested in what the future looks like in terms of what he's working on. Yeah, again, congratulations to him and others who have been working on this.
So Dr. Norm Chambers was a professor of Africana Studies for years at San Diego State University, also person-centered therapy with the eminent Carl Rogers. And Norm has worked all over the world. He helped diffuse the Irish Protestant Catholic stuff. He did some stuff in South Africa. He worked with big corporations. Norm is not a lightweight, and he will ask critical questions like you, Dr. Ra. You and him should meet each other.
All right. Good. I spoke at San Diego State when Dr. Weber was there a couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
Back in a long time ago. But anyway, Mashinda, did you have any questions before we close out?
No, just interesting conversation tonight. Appreciate the presentation. And thank you again. I'm good. Thank you.
Okay, Brother Rasha Key.
Yes, I just appreciate Brother Shahid coming on. I checked out some of his information beforehand and very extraordinary. And I see where he gets all his talent from. Very, very, you know, talented family. Excellent. Just enjoying myself.
If you don't mind, one more 30-second commercial, because he mentioned Dr. Weber. You guys need to know that Dr. Weber's from L.A., and she grew up in the Nickerson Gardens.
Yeah,
she grew up in the Nickerson Gardens. Okay, and look at her now. Secretary of State. For California.
You went former California State Senator, California State Assembly person too.
Right.
She's and head of Black Studies at that time, Black Studies before it was Africana Studies at San Diego State for years. And when she tried to retire, they had to bring her back to keep the program going. So
right.
Yeah, there's a long history of contributions and struggle.
Right. Charles C. Platt got Frederick Roberts, our first state assemblyman. He was his campaign manager. That's right. In the book.
All right. Brother Hembrick, are you there? Historian Hembrick, you got the mute on. Well, let me just say this to you, brother. This has been one fantastic presentation. History, as Malcolm said, is the one science that rewards all research.
Mm.
Yeah. When you focus on history, it's the foundation of all understanding. You want to understand anything, you look at its history. I don't care if it's a potato chip, the ladybug, whatever.
Right.
That's how you understand. Even your husband, wife, girlfriend, whatever, you need to know their history.
Right.
History is the foundation of all understanding. And the more history you have, as Dr. Karenga said, the more humanity you have. And so we deeply appreciate your presentation on these unsung heroes and the in-depth and meticulous methodology that you have written these books and included essential collateral information that will enhance the knowledge and expand the knowledge of whoever reads it. In other words, they're not only going to learn about the person, they're going to learn about the times, and they're going to learn about the institution, and they're going to learn about the documentation that you have included. So that makes you a really outstanding contributor to our mental liberation and admiration and appreciation of ourselves. And so we deeply appreciate your presentation. And we extend to you an open invitation to come back and make other presentations. And we extend to your guests who came, Sister Norman, my alumni sister, and especially Victoria, because she, you know, a UCLA graduate and then worked on major projects all over the LA area. We would like to extend an invitation for her to even come on and speak about her experiences as a woman.
Yes.
And the challenges that she went through. Yeah. So we deeply appreciate Darlene, Galaxy, our brother Mashinda, and everybody that chimed in. This has been one enlightening episode that will be on YouTube and on our website. And a million, and as I said, the grains on the ocean floor, the sand of grains on the ocean floor are few compared to the many thanks that we give to you for your presentation, brother AGN. And you're one of our alumni also. So good things come out of the centennial, good things come out of Compton, and we deeply appreciate and want. And Willowbrook. Yes, Ms. Victoria.
I just want to say that my STEM program that I had at Charles Drew University of Medicine and Science, we worked with we had students from the three high schools in Compton, and they were amazing. I mean, those students were so, so wonderful. We never told them that they were doing undergrad and graduate level experiments every week, and they just knocked them out. I mean, they just, you know, they just did, you know? And
my son went to Drew High School. One of my sons.
That's on the same kind of on the same property as the university.
Yeah, little Ernie Smith, little Ernie, the Ebonics conferences all the time. We know all of it.
I mean, if I see people, I always remember names, but I never forget a face.
Ernie Smith,
Ernie Smith. Oh yeah, of course. Oh, Ernie Smith. Yes, of course. Well, there were two Ernie Smiths.
Yeah, there were two pediatrician who made his transition. I spoke at his funeral, and at his home going. And Ernie, me and Ernie are very close. And the whole Drew family. And they used to have the Drew Jazz concert over there. So that's a very fantastic area. But I just want to say, brother, you know, I know you got a lot more information and a lot more to share. So feel free to let us know when you want to come back and make some more presentation. And Norma, stay tuned. You know how to come on. We are on every Monday and Wednesday. And all we do is talk Black truth. And as Brother Ajin was saying, there's a lot of unsung heroes.
Yes.
And when we honor those unsung heroes, we honor in ourselves also.
Yeah.
The best in us as a people. So Brother Rasaki, you want to close out and tell them what's happening Wednesday?
And we can't forget the She Rose.
Yeah,
we can't forget that. That's our backbone. Okay, so now on Wednesday, we have a brother named Kevin G coming on, and he's going to talk about the value of how we address ourselves, and that N word is going to be addressed. Hmm. So that should be very interesting.
Hmm.
And coming up in 2 weeks, I want to start getting this out there. We got our first person in Ghana that's going to be a guest. And that's going to be a special edition show. It's going to be on a Thursday at 11 a.m. on June 30th. So I want to start promoting that. That should be very interesting. So, all right, everyone. I appreciate everybody coming here and giving us this great information. You guys are excellent. I just don't have words to say how awesome you guys are. So each one teach one in Conscious Corner. Have a good evening.
All right, everybody. Take care.
Good night.